This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Lulu Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book is titled Burning the Short White Coat, a story of becoming a woman doctor. Dr. Eve Schfidler joins me from the Northwest in Tacoma, Washington, Seattle area. Thank you for joining me today and talking about your novel.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I'm honored to visit with you. I understand both you and your spouse are doctors, and I will mention for my listeners who cannot see the cover, this has reminiscent reflections of the Victoria's Secrets catalog, Burning the Short White Coat. Did you specifically want the cover design to be provocative in nature?
Yes, I wanted it to leave a little bit to the imagination, and I also wanted it to kind of show the dichotomy of what you find when you read the novel.
This is fictional work. You have, I'm sure, taken some things from your experiences in life as a doctor, a physician. Share with my listeners where the idea for this book came from and why you decided to become an author in addition to being a doctor.
Well, I've always kept journals and enjoyed journaling. Lots of times my journals were focused more as when I was younger about my love life and just dealing with boy problems. But during medical school, I'd come home from my training and I was just sort of blown away by all the experience that all the experiences we would have as doctors in training. And I felt like I had to write about these experiences. So I kept a lot of notes with the most interesting, heartbreaking, outrageous, hilarious experiences. And I have like sticky notes, you know, all over my house. When I was in my training, just, I have to remember this one. And when I wrote my novel, I wanted to capture the raw experience and perspective of medical school training through the eyes of a medical student in real time. And, you know, I thought, well, what if I mix that up with sort of that Sex in the City, Grey's Anatomy appeal so that people are entertained as they're reading through the material?
Have you always had a passion for the written word? Have you always kept journals from back before you were even graduated from high school, maybe even junior high?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. I've always been, I've got, you know, stacks of them from the time I was probably about 10 years old is when I started journaling.
Amazing.
So, you know, I would come home from work in medical school because people ask me, well, how did you have time to write a book during medical school? Well, that was my way to sort of unwind and relax, you know, after a really crazy or harrowing day, or just take a break from studying because, you know, there's only so much of that you can do and you need to kind of shift your focus so that you can replace that focus back where it really matters in your studies. You can't just study for 14 hours straight. I mean, it's not effective.
Mm. Any early written influences, writers, authors that have maybe influenced your style, do you think?
Well, I think I sort of got the idea of the book when I read this book called House of God, which is a classic novel. It's about, it's written by a guy named Samuel Shem. That's his pen name. And he wrote about his first year of internship. And it sort of mixes up the sex and the running around and the fooling around that occurs in the hospital with the actual experience of becoming a physician. But it's very male focused. I mean, it appeals more to a male audience. And so I thought, well, what if I did the female version of that? So that was sort of where the idea came. And then I really enjoy chick lit. I enjoy, you know, there's a book called The Second Assistant. It's about, you know, a young woman who becomes an agent. She works as an agent in Hollywood, or an assistant to an agent in Hollywood. And it's also about her love life. The Devil Wears Prada. Mm-hmm. It's about a woman who wants to become a journalist or work for a magazine, and her love life. So it's sort of that formula of chick lit occupation or coming of age occupation with the love life stuff. And there's nothing in medicine that's novelized in that form. So I thought it would be unique in that way.
any interest in turning this into a screenplay? Do you think there's enough action and activities in here that may generate some interest that way?
Well, it's interesting that you asked me that, because when I wrote my novel years ago, and it's kind of been sitting and collecting dust for the last 10 years. But when I first wrote it, it was before the TV show Grey's Anatomy, and I had a couple of people call me after Grey's Anatomy came out, and they said, "Who stole your book and turned it into Grey's Anatomy?" So, you know, the concept I don't think is an unusual concept of having this medical school training or residency training dramatized on the big screen. Whether or not my novel will ever make it to that place, I don't know, but it's not a unique concept.
Share with us your main character. What is he or she? In this case, it's a chicklet novel, so it must be a gal. Share what her story is in your novel.
Well, her name is Elle Gallagher, and she starts out as a first-year medical student, she originally lives in the Southwest, where it's nice and warm and cozy and a pretty easy, laid-back lifestyle, to being dropped into her first day of medical school, which is in a room full of dead bodies during her gross anatomy lab. So, and then just her journey of trying to find herself as a woman, you know, a professional woman, and the challenges of dating and having relationships in that arena, and also putting together all of the building blocks in her brain and in her mind and in her soul as to understanding what it is to become a doctor. That journey.
What is the most exciting scene that you've created, do you think?
The most exciting scene that I've created. Well, there's so many great parts.
You're not prejudicial about your writing, are you?
Well, no. I mean, there's just fun parts of the story, and there's also a lot of really. There's also sad parts as well. But my favorite chapter is the neurosurgery chapter.
The neurosurgery chapter. Is there graphic evidence of surgery taking place and all of those other blood and guts things that happen in surgery?
There's a little bit of blood and guts. There's a lot of patient stories. There's also sort of the most fun part of it is just the interactions that the different residents have in neurosurgery as they're going through that, as the main character goes through that rotation, and the way that they interact with each other, the way they talk to each other, the hierarchy of the hospital and the training and the way that it works. So I think it's more about those types of interactions that make it interesting. And then there's also some interesting patient stories in that chapter.
Other than the cover, would guys be interested in your storyline, or is this primarily directed towards the feminine side of the readership?
No, I mean, I think that male men would be interested. I don't know how many men or what percentage of men actually enjoy reading chick lit novels. But there is a lot of medical stories in there, and I have had a lot of male readers tell me that they've enjoyed reading the book, but I would say it caters more to a female audience.
What's your underlying theme, do you think, from the story? Is it just adventure and Sex and the City replicated, except in a more enticing and entertaining way, or how would you describe it?
I would describe it as Sex and the City goes to medical school.
All right. I mean, all right, yes. And you have other characters, I'm sure, as well in the book. Who is going to be discovered as an interesting character that might make it to a sequel?
That's a good question. There's a doctor that is an attending. And so in the hospital, there's sort of a hierarchy. You have the medical student, which is the lowest person on the totem pole, and then, you know, the four different years of medical students. Then there's interns, which is the first year of residency. Then there's residents. Then there's fellows, which is after residency. Not everybody does a fellowship. And then there's attending. So they're like sort of once you go through all the training and all the experiences and then you get hired on as an attending, that's like the top position, one of the top positions you can be in. I guess above that is the chief. So in the story, there is an attending that the main character is interested in as a medical student, and they have, I don't want to give too much away, but there
oh,
is
go ahead.
Um, some romantic interaction that occurs, and so that character could make it to a sequel.
Did you start with an outline on each chapter? How did you begin the creative process? I have authors who just sit down and all of a sudden they get zapped with a creative concept and just start writing. Or did you have an outline of your characters, the people you wanted to include in this story to begin with?
Yeah, I probably did it a little bit backwards, and if I am working on the sequel, I'm going to be a little bit more organized in the way that I do it now. But originally, I didn't know I was going to write a novel. I was just sort of keeping track of all these stories, very interesting stories from my training, and so I started writing those thoughts down, and then I wove the characters throughout those stories.
What story were you drawn to as a child? What was the first novel or first book or story that you remember?
Charlotte's Web.
Charlotte's Web, okay.
Secret Garden.
Those kinds of things.
Pollyanna.
Mm. Those all seem...
My mom used to read those books to me when I was a kid.
Those stories end up with a positive ending or an upbeat ending. Does your novel follow that same pattern?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think it has the ending that most people would expect from a chick lit novel, but I think it has a pretty empowering ending.
Describe for my listeners.
It opens it up for a sequel.
Opens it up for a sequel. Describe for my listeners how you would introduce your book. How would you get them interested in Burning the Short White Coat?
I guess sort of what you would read on a back of a book. I guess I'm not really understanding the question.
Let me rephrase the question. How would you describe your book to someone that doesn't even have a clue that you, in addition to being a physician, are also an author? I'm stumping you, aren't I?
I guess I'm not really knowing how to answer the question.
I guess I should ask a medical question if I could think of one. Why I have spots and things on my hands, I don't know. Something that's more pertinent to what you're focused on right now. The sequel, are you expanding the storyline that you've already created, or is there something else that you are delving into as far as character development?
Well, the sequel, so the training just continues after medical school. Then you have to go on to your specialty training. So there's another 4 years of training, or anywhere from 3 to 9 training that one would go through after medical school. And so the main character at the end is moving on to residency, and that's a whole other experience in of itself. So I think there's a lot of material to work with for a sequel.
Do you think the book is, and the storyline is, different enough that it will gain some standing in the community of published authors?
Well, I definitely think it's unique in the fact that the majority of the books that have, well, except for House of God, which was written by Samuel Shem, all of the books that I can find that have been written by physicians about becoming a doctor and going through medical school are memoirs or autobiographies about people's experiences. So there hasn't really been a novelized form of, you know, Grey's Anatomy or, you know, the TV shows that are very popular about, you know, becoming physicians or being doctors. There's not really a lot of novelized forms of those themes. Everything has been autobiographical. And frankly, the autobiographical accounts, while several of them have been very interesting, I think that they appeal to a smaller population of readers because there isn't as much about the running around, dating, personal life stuff in them, you know, that keep people kind of interested in the read.
Thank you very much for sharing your background story on this book and this novel, Burning the Short White Coat. When it becomes a feature film, keep me in mind for a part as the dead guy on the gurney. Alrighty. Burning the Short White Coat, a story of becoming a woman doctor, our physician and author, Dr. Eve Schwidler. Thank you for joining me today. Where can my listeners get a copy of this book?
There is on Amazon.com. is where you can get it. You can also get it on lulu.com and barnesandnoble.com.
Do you have a website developed yet?
Not yet.
But it's in the works, so they can do a search.
In the works.
They can search under your name, last name, Schwidler, if they're trying to pursue you in a gentle way, and can find out about this book, Burning the Short White Coat, and the sequel, which is in the works. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks.
For Indie Book Publishing, Lulu Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Congratulations on being the proud owner of an adorable, soft, cuddly, sweet-smelling, smiling, cooing, hungry, tired, gassy, screaming little bundle of joy. So now what? Where's the owner's manual for this thing? Where are my instructions? Right here. It's Baby and Toddler Instructions with Blythe Lipman on TogiNet.com. Infant care specialist Blythe Lipman has worked with babies for over 20 years and works extensively with new parents, providing workshops, in-home visits, tips, and daily phone calls to ease those frazzled nerves. With Baby and Toddler Instructions, you can get the advice you need on how to survive and enjoy your baby's first year. For more information on Blythe and how she can help you, go to babyinstructions.com. From 32 ways to stop a baby from crying to 14 ways to get a baby to eat and so much more. It's Baby and Toddler Instructions with Blythe Lipman on TogiNet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Indie Book Publishing. My name is Deb Han. It's my pleasure today to bring you Helena Letao. How are you, Helena?
Thank you. I'm okay.
Excellent. It's great to have you, and I'm so happy to introduce you to our listeners and to talk about your book, The Visible and the Invisible Reality, Expansious Consciousness. Tell our listeners a little about this, because I know the title in and of itself is very intriguing, but this is a very special work for you. Can you give our listeners an insight into it, please?
You mean what's in the book?
Yeah.
The main content is spiritual life, esoteric philosophy, the supernatural, parapsychology. These are all subjects in which I have work experience and life experience. The book wants to show the reader that there is more than we just can see. What your eye sees is different than what my eye sees.
It's very true. It's very true. And you write that brilliantly. You've done that very well. And it was a real... It's not a book that you've written in the last 6 months or 12 months. You've really dedicated a good portion of your life to writing this book, haven't you?
Yes, it took me 7 years, 7 winter, to sit down in the morning first thing.
Yeah.
2 hours concentrate on writing and on nothing else. Before my mind is occupied with anything else, writing comes first, and it still is the case today. In the morning, I do writing. Not a book, but whatever writing.
Yeah, that's so impressive. It's so disciplined to do so. And the thing I find so impressive around that is the way, as I read your book, over the course of the weekend, and I was aware that you wrote it over the course of 7 years. It's seamless. You know, you write so fluently, and it links brilliantly. So that's great consistency in the way you write over that time. Tell me, or share with us, if you will, what inspired you to write The Invisible and the Invisible in Expansious Consciousness?
I had never in mind to write a book, even so writing is in the family. But I had so many unusual experiences, be it in work, being private, supernatural experiences as well. But then I had an experience which was, I would say, it happened never before in this world, almost.
Yeah.
That was so great that I just knew I have to write a book. It was not that I wanted to write a book. I had to write the book that people can read and can make their own judgment. Maybe it changes their life, which obviously has done with some people already.
Yeah. And seriously, written so genuinely, I enjoyed reading your book. I love the beginning of your book because you start, you know, the opening page, the opening one, two pages is really your childhood. And tell us a little bit about that because that's really, it's really when it started for you, isn't it?
Yes, I did know that I have to start with my own person, this book, and not write just about philosophy, etc. I wanted to show the reader who is that person who experiences such unusual things. So I started as a child when I sat on the back of my, behind the back of my mother on a bike, and we drove through Basel, and we came to an accident where a person was lying on the side of the road, and people came and covered the body. And I asked my mother what happened, and she said, it's an accident, just don't look. But I did look. And I asked, what is it? And she said, well, the person is dead. And I said, what is dead? And that was the moment when all my philosophy searching started and wanting to know the truth. I asked, what is dead? Where has the person gone? And that was when I was a young child, 3 or 4 years old.
And such a powerful question at 3 and 4 years of age. You know, what is dead? Where is the person gone? I totally understand that from the concept of, you know, as a young child, you can see the body there, but what does it mean to be dead? You know, and yeah, that was the beginning of really your life mission in a way. So, and you've had some extraordinary experiences throughout the time, like you said before, some supernatural experiences, and, you know, have you ever felt scared or intimidated or unsafe or anything like that with any of the supernatural experiences that you've had?
That's a good question. No, actually not. I was never scared. I'm not a person who has any fear of whatever. No, I was never scared, but I was very often totally surprised or couldn't believe, or like, oh my God, how on earth can this now happen, even if I clinically experience that and that and that and that and that, and it is a reality. All these things were a reality which I could prove. That made it even more special. But no, fair not, no. But very much surprised.
It was interesting when you were talking about or writing about being in a haunted house at one point in time,
yeah,
and there was the piece around the shoes where you thought a cat had been playing with your shoe or something.
Yeah,
so
it's all reality here. Yeah.
It's true, and what was interesting was, you know, you then sort of went on and you spoke about that, gave you a clue as to the age of the spirit, the ghost, you know, whatever you want to define the being as being, because it sort of let you know that they, if it was a modern, like some of the past, in the last 50 to 100 years, they wouldn't have been aware of the traditions around the shoes, and, you know, some of the old buildings that are built with shoes in their foundations, and like churches even that have, you know, shoes in their foundations because it's customary to ward off the evil spirits and so on. So that was fascinating little insight.
Yeah.
So there you go. You don't have to read it with your shoes on, people. It's okay. Unless you want
to. Well, I hope the ghost won't visit them when they read this chapter.
It's very true.
It's not only about ghosts, it's about other things as well, but the ghost stories are very, very interesting and true.
Yeah.
I have to point out, they are true, and I have proof. Many times other people were there who could testify that and that happened.
Yeah. So there's other work that you've done around the parapsychology as well. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what you do there? And again, because it's all about proof, and you document this, some of the particular sessions in the book as well. So do share some of that experience and awareness for our listeners.
Well, first I started past life regression to see what happens by putting somebody in a deep trance, not only in a superficial hypnosis, in a deep trance, and leading that person back without having something particularly in mind. It's not that this person had a problem or whatever. The person was a subject just to work with it. So we went back in time and became into a different country at a different time, maybe the 16th century, and then we were at a place which looks that and that and that, and there was this house, such and such and such, and a person with a name so-and-so lived there, all details of what happens, and that was, I noted this, I write it down, and we could check this later on with history. Was this indeed the case? And so everything was correct.
Quite fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. And you went on to detail in your book about, you spoke about your childhood, you spoke about your professional dealings, your own family. Have any of your children displayed any of the skills that you have, or have they followed in your footsteps in any way?
They all are artistic, mm-hmm. and I guess writing is an artistic skill too. And my son is a journalist, the best journalist in the world.
Of course he is.
But in exploring death and life before death, no, they don't. They don't work on this same level.
Okay.
I don't think so.
I was just curious. And and tell me about as far as writing now. You still continue to write?
I do a lot of writing. Lot.
Yeah.
Not a book.
Not a book.
I do. Not a book. No.
So we can't have another follow-on book around what happens next.
I'm not sure whether I want to stay such much longer on the planet Earth.
Okay.
But I have many, many notes. Maybe somebody makes a book out of it sometime.
You never know.
And actually, what I would like is to see a film.
Oh,
made,
would you like to see
out
this?
Of the book. Made out of the existing book. That would be the first film which would be true on the subject which they nowadays do films about the paranormal, and they're all made up.
Yeah.
Sometime, I have to say, stupid way.
Yeah.
Should do a film with the true fact behind it. That would be good.
It would be interesting. I'd like to see that movie, I must say. Now, tell me, Helena, where can our listeners get a copy of the Visible and the Invisible Expansious Consciousness?
Any bookshop can order it from Balboa Press
mm-hmm.
in America. Or Amazon have it.
Yes, and you were telling me that Amazon already has a 5-star rating on Amazon?
5-star rate has Amazon on
it. Fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. Congratulations.
And in Australia or in Tasmania, people can order it, have it from the order myself.
Excellent. So, Helena, thank you so much for sharing this with us today. And I must share with our listeners, when Helena and I were talking last week to set up today's interview, and I told her that I would be reading her book over the course of the weekend, what you need to understand is right now this interview is happening just after Easter, and she was so excited that I was going to read the book over Easter. And and I would say to you, when you read this book, keep that in mind, because it's so relevant and it's quite enlightening. So Helena, thank you so much for your time this afternoon. It's been an absolute pleasure getting to know you, and who knows, maybe we will see this in film. It would be absolutely worth the watch, I can assure everybody. So thank you
for having me.
It's been a pleasure. Okay, my name is Deb Han, and it's been a pleasure to be with you this afternoon. Until next time, bye for now.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 central on toginet.com. Helen Wu was born and raised in San Francisco's Chinatown, and after a very difficult upbringing, fighting depression, abuse, and addictions, she finally finds herself genuinely happy inside and out. Helen believes in taking our positive thinking and doing something positive to achieve a positive outcome. She's here to make a positive difference in your life, to be your game changer, your aha moment mentor. She's ready to help both men and women get into a better place. Helen Wu is also the author of Self-Aid Success Stories, 25 Success Stories from Successful Entrepreneurs. Inspired by Ellen DeGeneres, Helen wants the world to know that just because we find ourselves in a difficult situation doesn't mean we have to stay there. We can aid ourselves to a better life. So join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 central on toginet.com.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Welcome along to Author Talk on Toginet Radio. I'm your host, Rick Bell. Now, we're going to be talking about marketing, and marketing is something people immediately associate with business. However, marketing is very much something we all use on a day-to-day business. If you're applying for a job, you're marketing yourself. If you're trying to get that all-important first date, you're marketing yourself. But someone who knows more than most about marketing is my guest today, Denise Drummond-Dunn, who's written a new book called Winning Customer Centricity. Welcome to the show, and thank you for joining me. Now, first of all, tell us what exactly is customer centricity about.
Hi, Rick. Thank you for the introduction and for the question. Customer centricity is close to my heart. Customer centricity has actually become a bit of a buzzword these past few years, and it's something that is important to business, as you said, and it's just basically making companies think about their customers more closely and putting them at the heart of their business. So really thinking customers first in everything they do.
Why did you write this book, first of all?
I wrote the book, Rick, because I saw so many companies talking about the importance of the customer, but they weren't actually walking customer centricity. So they were saying that they knew the customer was important. And in today's world, the customers quickly tell you if they're unhappy with your products or services. And yet they still were making very basic mistakes, not thinking about the customer first in what they do.
Can you give me some examples of where companies have gone wrong and also where companies are doing things right? Now, the one thing from a business point of view that we like to see is customers are quite willing to complain, and quite rightly so. But it's also nice if customers give positive feedback. Give me some examples where you think companies can encourage customers to want to give feedback and how businesses are doing it wrong.
Well, it's absolutely true that we're much quicker to complain than we are to congratulate a company or a brand about their services. And unfortunately, social media has made that very easy for people to complain. An example of a company I can think of that was talking customer centricity but not walking customer centricity was actually a food manufacturer. And their call centres were open from 10 till 12 and 2 till 4. But when were their customers likely to be using their products, their food products, would be breakfast, lunch or dinner time. So in fact, when the customer wanted to ask a question about the product, there was actually nobody there to answer them. And as I said, this was a company that was definitely customer-centric, but something as simple as that, they hadn't thought about. Another example, and it's something I tend to do when I go in to talk to clients, is that I'll just have a look at their website. And I'm sure most of us have tried to contact a company at some point and looked on their website for a tag saying contact. And when you click on it, instead of it coming up with their telephone number and their email and maybe their postal address, etc., what we get is this form to fill in with name and address and telephone number and email and everything about us, plus space to write our question down. And that goes off into cyberspace, and we don't know what happens to all that information. Now, a customer-centric company would not force their customers to contact them only in that way. They would make it easy for the customer to contact them in the way they want to be contacted. So they would offer telephone numbers and email addresses, etc., so that the customer can contact the company how they want to. And it's a small thing, but quite often when I go into a new client, it's something I'll always check because it's a very good indicator of how customer-centric they are.
Well, the one thing I feel very strongly about, and it confirms exactly what you've just said, is many customers would like to contact the company or the business anonymously without giving away their own personal details. And as you quite rightly say, filling in one of these forms doesn't do that. It doesn't allow the customer just to make a general inquiry without giving out their details. And I know many people are also concerned, for example, if they're giving out their email address or their phone number and so on, is that they're concerned that this information could potentially be sold as a marketing product in itself. Have you come across much experience of that?
Oh, absolutely. And I think customer privacy is going to become a real challenge for companies. And even those that guarantee we won't sell or use your information for marketing purposes, as you know, in these past years, there's been a lot of news about hacking, even banks and such like, that have had their database hacked open and names and passwords and such stolen. So I do think that customers are going to become much more sensitive to whom they give that information. And unfortunately, it's likely to stop them contacting brands and companies online. And what they will do, and I have to say I do it myself, if I don't get satisfaction, I will tweet about it. Because I know that if I tweet a comment, then the company will respond to me normally within about 10 or 15 minutes. Whereas sometimes if you fill in a form online, it can be days before you'll get an answer. And as I said, I regret doing that myself sometimes, but I think that companies have to realize that we consumers, we are losing our patience, and we realize and we are voicing the power that we have today over brands and companies and the success of them through the use of social media.
Now, you've said that your book, the book that you've written, is a totally new format as a business book. Can you explain more about what you mean?
Yes, absolutely. I think you only have to look at the cover to realise that, Rick. I don't know many business books that have a cartoon on the front cover. But when I wrote the book, I started, as I am a customer-centric champion, by thinking about the sort of people that I was targeting my book to. In other words, corporate marketeers, executive members of the board in companies, general managers, vice presidents, that sort of level. I remember when I was in the corporate world, I had tens of books sitting on my shelves, but I never actually read them. At best, I flicked through them, but I rarely took away ideas and actioned them. So starting from that identification of the problem, I decided that I needed to write a different sort of business book. So the book actually has 50 chapters. It may sound a lot, but in fact, each chapter only has 2 pages. So the idea is that you read 1 chapter a week. It's why there's 50 chapters. You get 2 weeks off for vacation. And the chapter, as I said, is 2 pages. It includes an inspiring quote on the topic of the chapter, the objectives for the week, a cartoon just to make it more attractive and appealing to read, then the actions that I'm suggesting you take, and if you yourself can't think of how to apply it in your own company, I include examples from other companies as well as some additional ideas on how to do the action for the week. Now, of course, you don't have to read one chapter a week. You can read several chapters in a day if you want, because they only take a few minutes each to read. The idea really is that you try to go through all the chapters throughout the year. Now, it doesn't have to be read in order. If you know you have a problem in a particular area, and the book is divided into four areas, if you know the area of your development opportunity, then you can go directly to that section of the book and start there. But if you are starting at the beginning of your customer-centric journey, then I would suggest you start from chapter one and just go through to the end.
Now, can you give our listeners some examples of the suggestions that your book makes that appeal to a particular sector or business?
Well, let's take the very first chapter. The first chapter is the start of your customer-centric journey. So all I suggest in the first week is that you make it known that the company is going to become more customer-centric. Now, obviously, if you have a board member that is supporting the initiative, that really helps. And my suggestion would be you find ways to make everybody in the company aware that the customer is important. So I've suggested, for instance, signing your emails with a slogan such as, we don't pay your salary, it's the customer that does, or there are no brands without customers. Things like this that are just reminding people of the importance of the customer and the importance of everybody in the company to support that initiative, because everybody in the company has a role to play in satisfying and hopefully delighting the customer.
Now, can you share with us some examples? Now, we're talking about earlier about companies who get things badly wrong. They have all the right ideas, but they put them into service wrong. For example, having a food company that has their contact centres or call centres opened at times that would not really be convenient for the customers who are likely to contact them. Can you give us some examples where companies have been doing things wrong but have turned things around, and how they've achieved that?
I think the way to do it is really the companies that succeed are those that think customer first. And how they've done it, and as I said, the book is full of examples, but it can be as simple as having pictures of customers in your reception area. I know another company who has pictures of their customers on all their lift doors, just to remind people that those are the people that are buying their products. Those are the people they're trying to satisfy. Another company, they used to take all the comments, both good and bad, from the call centres and put them on a notice board in the restaurant as well as at the lifts, so that whilst people are standing, waiting or talking, they can read what customers are talking about, either their complaints, a new flavour that they don't like, or positive comments such as suggestions for a new product or a new packaging or something like that. So really having the customer's words listened to and acted upon on a day-to-day basis. So really just bringing the customer to the heart of the business and making sure that everybody is thinking about the customer as they go about their daily duties and work.
Now, in closing, what is the one piece of advice from everything that you've written in your book? What is the one piece of advice that you would like to offer readers of your book and listeners to this show that you think is most important?
For me, the advice would be, if you have any doubts that you are or are not customer-centric, then have a look on my website, which is www.c3centricity.com, where you can actually run a free evaluation of your company to find out how customer-centric you are. Apart from that, if you have any doubts, obviously buy the book or download again on my website. You can download as of next month of 5 free chapters. And if you don't want to do any of that, then I would say start with the customer in your mind in everything you do. Start every meeting by identifying who is the customer you're talking about. End meetings by saying, what would the customer think of the decision we've just taken? Would they agree with it or not? So just getting into the habit of thinking about your customers, whether it's of your brand or a company, if you have many brands, and just always checking in your mind how your customers would react to the decisions and the way you're working. And if you think that they would disapprove, well, change the way you're working.
Now, earlier on, you talked about the fact that you spend much of your working day writing. Does that mean that we can expect a follow-up to the book that we've been talking about on this show?
Oh, well, thank you for asking that, Rick. Yes, the book is actually designed to be the first in a series. The second one that's nearing completion at the moment is about insight development, because in today's world of big data, we are inundated by data and information. But as I'm often quoted as saying, we're thirsting for insight. And it's a book, the same format, 50 very short chapters, to help people to develop insight from all the information they have. And then the third one, which is also in progress, is about updating your innovation processes, because customers are becoming far more demanding and we don't stay satisfied for long, as my blog last week talked about. I think that consumers have become so demanding that companies have to constantly innovate and renovate. And so the third book in the series will be about innovation.
During the interview, we talked about how customer feedback is important to any business. Here's what just one of Denise's many clients had to say about how Denise helped their business to grow in the marketplace. Denise was immensely helpful in providing an independent, insightful external view of our business and our customers. Her participation in a research project allowed us to look at the market from a new perspective and uncover critical questions and issues quicker. Drawing from her deep experience and understanding of customer behaviour around the globe, she was able not only to guide a research effort, but more importantly, to interpret and analyse the results. Her easygoing and direct style facilitated lively and energetic discussions. I would highly recommend Denise for any group looking for fresh, eye-broad experience and a quick mind to add substantial value to a customer research effort. Richard Treadwell, VP Global Marketing, Biosensors. And many thanks to my guest today, the author Denise Drummond-Dunn, talking about her new book, Winning Customer Centricity, which is published by C3 Centricity and is available from all good bookstockers. This is Rick Bell for Toggenet Radio. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.